It's been nearly 3 months since the United States formally departed and ended the war in Afghanistan. Our next guest documented one of the biggest challenges to the now overthrown Afghan government and the U.S. mission there, corruption at all levels of that government. And she says, well, the details may look different. We have a major corruption problem here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about corruption in the U.S., in the government, in the business world, or beyond? What kind of solution or solutions would you like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Chase is a former international reporter for NPR who covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan, then remained living in the Taliban stronghold Kandahar for nearly a decade. From 2009 to 2011, she advised two commanders of the international military forces in Afghanistan. Her latest book is called On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. It recently came out in paperback. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
I want to start in Afghanistan before we turn to the United States. Something that really struck me, re-looking at your book, Sarah, some of your Afghan colleagues where you were looking there while you were working there, saying people joining the Taliban weren't necessarily doing it because they agreed with the Taliban or their religious mission, but because they were fed up with the corruption at all levels of Afghan government. Can you talk about what an incredible force that corruption was?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, on the ground, you encountered it every time you came up against a government official, be it a police officer, a doctor, because the hospitals were public, school teachers. I know someone who was trying to get the death certificate for his father was blown up in a suicide bombing and had to pay a bribe. And the problem with that so-called petty corruption is it's not just about money. It's the way they take your money from you. It's not like they ask for it nicely, which frankly, Afghans would probably give it if they did. It's the contempt. It's the kind of humiliation that goes with it. So that's at the street level. Then what I learned is part of that kind of those low-level bribes, which might be, or extortions really, which might be, I don't know, 20 cents, 50 cents, more to an Afghan than to us, but so-called petty. But a portion of it makes its way up the line. And there were a couple of studies done around 2010, I think, came up with the total amount of money extorted from people in Afghanistan being between $2 and $5 billion a year. So that's the sort of vertical integration. And then of course you have the capturing of all of the plum contracts and reconstruction projects. And that's why, I mean, ironically, all the money that got poured into Afghanistan in reconstruction and development, sometimes it actually was counterproductive in terms of how people felt about the whole mission. Because if that money was visibly being captured either by the village strongman or by, you know, the cronies of President Karzai, and was not really equitably reaching the people, well, then it would have almost better if it, sorry, it would have almost been better if it hadn't been spent at all. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Now, somebody in the United States might be listening and thinking, okay, to do, I might need to pay a fee to do things for my ordinary business. I generally don't need to slip a local official extra money to get whatever basic thing done. Corruption doesn't seem that readily visible in the United States. But you're really worried about corruption in the United States, Sarah. What is different about it here, but still pervasive, you say?
You put it perfectly, Rob. So we don't have the street level bribes, right? But there's another element of how corruption worked in Afghanistan that I started seeing in half a dozen other countries when I went and visited them, other countries around the world. And it's that it's not only vertically integrated, as I described, with the money, some of the money flowing up the system while protection flows down the system. That's the vertical structure. Then there's a horizontal structure, meaning, you know how we divide up our society. Like there's the businessmen, the private sector over here, and then you have the elected officials and the members of regulatory bodies. That's part of the public sector, and they're over there. And then you have the bad guys, and that's like the out and out criminals, or it's the terrorists, and they're across the room. What's distressing about the way corruption works when it becomes pervasive is that it's actually the work of networks. It's the operating system of networks. And the networks include members from each of these different sectors. We call it, you know, sometimes the revolving door. Like when someone from business, you know, let's say from a airplane manufacturing company goes and does 4 years in the Department of the Air Force and then comes back around. We call that the revolving door. That makes it sound like it's just one individual pushing the door. In fact, this is how the networks keep themselves woven, and this is how they bend and distort government, the powers and activities of government, to serve not the people, which is what it's supposed to be doing, but to serve the networks instead. And that's the facet, that's the face of corruption that once I started looking into it here in the United States, I saw in spades.
For an ordinary person who's not at that level, not in that network, it might be hard to see what the impact would be on their everyday lives. What does that, for example, that revolving door where somebody might regulate a business, then later go work for that business, what does that mean for people?
Wow, it means everything. So let's just take this back to Afghanistan for a second. Why is it that we built an Afghan army in our own image, an army that was heavily equipped, that was tied down to bases, that needed airplanes, that needed airplane mechanics, that needed, right? The Taliban didn't have bases. They didn't have air support. They didn't, you know, and they won. Why did we make a red coat army when we were fighting an insurgency? Well, one answer might be, where's the money, right? I mean, it was defense contractors that then, you know, cycle in and out of the Pentagon who shape how we think our armed forces, and by extension, the armed forces that we're supporting overseas, need to look. Well, guess what? We lost two wars. What about the revolving highway between Wall Street and the Treasury Department and regulatory agencies under its aegis? We got the economic meltdown of 2008. That was what, 4 million, I think, Americans put out of work? Put out of their homes, the almost collapse of the global economy. What about environmental devastation? And take a look at, I'm from West Virginia, and one of my senators is Joe Manchin. Well, he's deeply bought into coal and also pharmaceutical companies. So you start to see, you know, is he actually voting in the interests of the people of West Virginia, or is he voting in the interests of his network? And so what I would say is our victims, the victims of corruption, while we may not be smacked in the face by a cop for not coughing up a bribe, all the people who've lost their houses in the Great Recession, victims of the opioid crisis, which was a classic intermingling of the pharmaceutical companies and the DEA, for example, and Congress. And people who died in the wars are just some of them.
We're talking to journalist and writer Sarah Chase about her most recent book, just out in paperback, on corruption in America and what's at stake. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a corruption problem? Do you agree with what our guest is talking about there? Do you see solutions. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Sarah Chase about her latest book, On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. Came out in paperback just recently. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences maybe with corruption in the U.S. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, Ms. Chase. Interesting topic and a necessary one. I don't think you could come up with a better example of corruption than the current situation with the pharmaceutical influence on the vaccine push. The regulatory capture of the FDA, the CDC, all the way down the line, the opioid crisis was caused by the influence of pharmaceutical companies on virtually every level of the medical system in the United States. The people who died from those opioids didn't steal them from Walgreens. They got them from doctors.
Marcus, thanks for the call. You had touched, Sarah, on opioids just a few moments ago. Can you talk more about the network of corruption that you saw leading up to that?
Well, you know, I actually think Marcus puts his finger on a really interesting point here, which I have not heard covered. I can't say that I have personally done much research into how pharmaceutical companies, which, you know, as he points out, and as I pointed out, do not have a stellar record, how they have been functioning in the current COVID crisis. What I would say is that I have not yet heard once on, let's say, NPR, which I also listen to all the time, the connection that he just made. In other words, why wouldn't people today have some concern when the very same pharmaceutical companies that told them that OxyContin was not addictive are now telling them, you know, line up, salute, and take the vaccine? Now, I have both of them. I just am surprised that no one has made the connection between people in white coats assuring us that opioids were non-addictive and people in white coats today. And I think a little bit more exploration is needed there, a little bit more consciousness, and a little bit more explanation as to what's different now. What supervision has been placed on companies that we know were involved in wrongfully supplying huge quantities of opioids.
Thanks for that call, Marcus. Well, then that points toward a consequence of corruption more generally, a decline in trust. So even if an institution has a valid message, how do we know if they, you know, got it wrong for bad reasons last time?
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. And it's also why sometimes anti-corruption is sort of politicized. So you point at the corruption on the other side, but you're reluctant to look in the mirror. I think that afflicts all of us in the United States, and that cheapens the value of integrity. If you're not willing to hold your own family up to its highest standards, then, as you say, Rob, I think trust in the values themselves or in those who claim to defend them plummets.
Let's go now to Gene in Sun Prairie. Gene, hi.
Hi, Sarah. Say, I also want to commend you for the TED Talk that you did on corruption. I think that's fascinating, and I'd recommend this audience go look that up. But I'm very interested in your thesis about corruption. And it reminds me of the old mantra that the Americans are always fighting the last war. And why do we do that? And I think your idea of corruption plays into that by using air power, bombs, military bases, what are we doing? We're really benefiting the military-industrial complex in the United States rather than responding to the culture on the ground. And I think the latest book, too, about the Afghanistan papers really puts that point across as well, that the American military was clueless when it came to the culture and the conflicts between Sunnis and Shias, and so many people that went to serve in Afghanistan got the same basic lessons that people got that went to Iraq, but they're completely different war theaters.
Jean, thanks for the call, Sarah.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jean. I would just put two caveats on that. I did a lot of training of incoming units into Afghanistan, both European and, you know, and American. And I have to say, it wasn't normally exactly the same training they got for Iraq. Some units were scheduled to go to Iraq. That did happen. And then at the last minute, were shunted across to Afghanistan. But the second thing I'd say, and this may be counterintuitive, what you just said, Jean, and I said about the military, I think is correct. But I believe the biggest mistakes in the war in Afghanistan were made not so much by the military. I mentioned some of the military mistakes, but the biggest mistakes were condoning corruption, in fact, feeding it in the Afghan government, and also, and I don't really want to get into this now, but the role of Pakistan, which in fact basically ginned up the Taliban in the first place and reconstituted them starting 2003. Both of those issues were not military issues to solve. They were civilian issues. And I have to say, I am most disappointed in our senior civilian leaders who kind of shoved the war off onto the military, refused to address the significant and complicated and difficult issues of corruption and Pakistan. And then it becomes easy later to sort of haul the chairman of the Joint Chiefs up before Congress and say, why did you lose the war? Or why did you mess up the withdrawal? Whereas, unfortunately, the strategic civilian leadership was pretty much missing in action.
Jean, thanks for the call. We'll go to Barbara now in Mundelein, Illinois. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I'd like to know what the guest has to say about the changes in lobbyist rules and the changes in non-for-profit and political organizations and how just related to that.
Barbara, thanks
Great,
for the call.
Barbara.
You have a lot to say about that, Sarah.
Yeah. I mean, this is part of what we really have to get different. You know, in, I think as late as the 40s or 50s, you could not enforce a lobbying contract in a court of law because it was deemed an illegal contract. People could lobby. They were not stopped from lobbying, but it was really poorly looked upon. So the idea, and in particular, that you can both advocate for a policy position and basically tie that advocacy to money, seems to me if you want to advocate, you can't also be a bundler. I mean, I think that needs to be separated. And the NGO point is another terrific point, which is that there are a lot of organizations that do not pay taxes, meaning they're subsidized by the United States government, whose activity is almost entirely focused on influencing the United States government. And it's a difficult issue because both, I would say, left-leaning and right-leaning, or progressive and conservative, red and blue, organizations take advantage of this. And so that makes, I think, legislators of both sides reluctant to change this. But at the very least, and this is something California tried to do, make the donors public. If you're doing political work, if you are supporting issue or individual campaigns, then you have to, the public needs to know who's speaking to them. You know what I mean? If money is political speech, then at least let us know who's speaking to us. Barbara puts her finger, I think, on the critical point in corruption in America, which is the amount of money and invisible or dark money in our political system. It's out of control.
Barbara, thanks for the call. We have just over a minute left, Sarah. And one key point from your book, I think, is you don't want to see people just become so cynical or apathetic and just assume that corruption is here, always has been, always will be. What are you hoping to see from the public in just our last minute?
First of all, it hasn't always been. The last time it was this bad was between 1870 to 1935, and it took two world wars, a pandemic that makes COVID look like a joke, and an economic meltdown that makes 2008 look like a joke. So the first thing I want to say is we can't afford to tune out, because that series of calamities is lying right ahead if we do. And second, it's really start close to home. And I put a lot of ideas of things that ordinary people can do in their everyday lives. And I just feel that we, all of us, need to live our values, and we need to hold our own side, our own family, our own leaders, our own admired colleagues up to their highest standards.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Sarah Chase is a former international reporter for NPR, lived in Afghanistan for nearly a decade after covering the fall of the Taliban, and advised the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We talked to her about her most recent book, just out in paperback, On Corruption in America and What is at Stake.